Commerce and Imperial Expansion, 1815 to 1870. Most people have a visual image of the British Empire that is dominated by the way it looked in its heyday at the end of the 19th century. However, this is misleading when looking at the earlier part of the period, when the whole concept of empire was understood very differently. If we think of the early and middle years of the 19th century simply as a run-up to the rampant imperialism of the 1880s and 1890s, we are reading history backwards and badly misunderstanding Britain's relationship with the rest of the world in the earlier period, and possibly in the later period too. In the 1880s and 1890s, anyone could see where the British Empire was simply by looking at a map. But at the start of the century, it was much more uncertain. The British used the terms empire and imperial in a much broader and more flexible manner than they did later on. Being an empire in 1800 did not necessarily mean conquering other peoples. It was a term used to indicate an autonomous state beholden to no one. In Britain's case, it indicated the union of England, Scotland and Ireland that had been achieved in 1801. Newspaper reports of parliamentary debates were therefore often headed Imperial Parliament. Napoleon declared himself emperor, not of France's foreign conquests, but of the French people. He would still have been their emperor had he not conquered an inch of anyone else's territory. Empire at the start of the century therefore meant something more like dominion or area of authority. Indeed, the term was relatively seldom used in relation to Britain and its overseas territories. For of course Britain had overseas possessions, and these grew considerably during the Napoleonic period. But it would still be misleading simply to colour them in on a map, knowing that they were going to grow even more extensive later. What Britain had, or rather what various British interest groups had, was an extensive zone of influence and control, some of which was under direct British rule, but the majority of which was not. It is tempting to call this an empire, and no doubt, if pressed, people at the time would have recognised it as such. But it was more akin to the informal modern-day American empire, reliant on influence, trade, culture, and if absolutely necessary, force, than it was to the formal British Empire into which it later developed. 18th century Britain, like other European states, was at the centre of a mercantilist network of trading areas. Mercantilism was based on the idea that the world's trade and commerce were finite, and that states would prosper by protecting their share of it, and if possible, stealing other people's. Colonies were essentially commercial ventures granted a monopoly to feed the mother country with valuable commodities in a two-way relationship which worked to the advantage of each. Thus the American colonies, the West Indies and the East India Company all traded with Britain, but they did not trade with each other, or not officially at any rate. The flow of trade was controlled by parliamentary statute, notably the 17th century Navigation Acts, which were in turn enforced by Vigilant Navy and Customs Revenue Service. In this mercantilist empire, colonies were important essentially for the trade they produced. The people who lived in them were only of interest insofar as they contributed to that trade. However, there were signs, even in the 18th century, that that way of thinking would have to change. The American colonists had risen in revolt precisely because they felt that London had gone beyond the bounds of a proper commercial relationship and was starting to interfere in their private way of life. Shortly after the loss of America, Warren Hastings, Governor General of India, was accused in a high-profile trial in Westminster Hall of having ignored the needs of the people of Bengal, who had suffered from a devastating famine. As an official of a chartered trading company, Hastings might have been thought to have had no greater duty of care to the people of Bengal than anyone else. But since the company had been given political authority over Bengal, Hastings's prosecutors argued, responsibility for the welfare of the people now devolved onto the company's shoulders and those of its servants.